Hello and welcome to episode number 4 of Gin and Spook. We are your hosts. I'm Laura.
I'm Emma.
And tonight we have our guest star, Morgina Finney, with us. And what are we talking about today, Emma?
We are talking about female serial killers.
We thought we'd get the girls in after talking about the men. And what are you drinking tonight, Emma?
I'm drinking Sicilian lemon gin.
That sounds a little bit fancy.
It is very fancy.
I am drinking rhubarb and ginger gin, and we are recording this over Zoom because of lockdown number
2.0.
Damn you, coronavirus.
Hello.
So, Emma, do you want to start doing, give us some facts?
Yeah, I'm just going to inform you of some interesting facts about serial killers and some statistics.
Oh, I love a good statistic.
Me too, actually. I tried to find ones where they were like comparing female and male serial killers, but it's actually really difficult to find the information for it. So I had to like go through a lot of like reports and stuff that have been done in the past.
Yeah.
But as a just a general definition of a serial killer, it's typically a person who murders 3 or more people, usually in service of abnormal gratification, with the murders taking place over more than a month and including a significant period of the time between them. Most authorities hold a threshold of 3 murders, others extend it to 4 or to lessen it to 2 murders.
So you can't, it's not killing people in one go, is it? It's like...
No, because that would be a mass murder.
Yeah, cool. So you got to leave at least an hour between each body, lads. No, I'm kidding.
No, I mean, I don't know if that would still class as a serial killer, to be honest. I think probably it'd still not be like a mass murder.
Yeah, definitely.
That's a lot of effort in one day. So there are 4 types of serial killers: thrill seekers, mission oriented, visionary killers, and power/control seekers. So for thrill seekers, these are the serial killers that like outsmarting the law as some sort of amusement. They enjoy attention from the media, and they also enjoy being pursued by the police. They can be distinguished from other serial killers because of the fact that they send messages to others and keep detailed recordings of their killings. Due to this, it is logical to say that most thrill seekers are categorized as organized killers, but at the same time, they do not always plan everything out in advance. Thrill seekers are typically use weapons and or rape their victims before killing them. Mission-oriented serial killers are killers that feel the need, feel that they are doing society a favour by nodding, by ridding of certain people. So like young women, prostitutes, drug dealers or homosexuals. So like a good one would be Jack the Ripper.
Yeah. Or Dexter, because as in the TV show Dexter, because he was getting rid of other serial killers and bad people, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's true. If I was ever to be a serial killer, it'd be like Dexter.
Yeah, same.
You know, top some bad people off.
Yeah.
These people are generally not psychotic and see themselves as trying to improve society. They always have a controlled crime scene. So like Dexter, you're like, always put plastic wrapping everywhere. So naturally they will be classed as the organised killers, which makes them easier to track.
Yeah.
Unless you're Dexter, who can go for like how many seasons long without getting caught.
I know. I have never seen it all, to be honest. Just the first couple of series. But he worked with the police, wasn't he? A blood spatter expert or something.
Yeah, he was. So, like, obviously he had, you know, he was inside of obviously how the police work. And he had, you know, that background of being able to cover up his tracks.
Yeah.
And also had access to know who the bad guys were. So if he got away, he'd be able to just top them off.
Yeah.
And the mission-oriented killers are always the ones that go for like a specific type of victim, so it's easier to track them as well because they go for, you know, like I don't know, like brunette with blue eyes and then she's quite small and that kind of thing. Visionary serial killers occasionally suffer from psychotic outbreaks. They sometimes believe they are another person or they are compelled to murder by higher entities such as the god or devil. A good example of this is the killer David Bukowicz, who claimed that a demon transmitted orders to him through a neighbour's dog that had told him to kill.
Through the dog? That poor dog getting the blame for this.
And they tend to be more unorganised than other killers, which makes them very easy to track down.
Mm.
I think you would class, like, you know, if you were quite emotional, like going through emotional distress or something, and start stabbing people.
So it's like the kind of like crime of passion type people, almost. Yeah.
And your last one is power and control, which are the killers that enjoy their victims' terror, suffering, and screaming.
Proper sickos.
Yeah, these are like, you know, dominant people that have gone a bit too far kind of thing. These killers tend to be very organised and they usually have a history of childhood abuse, which left them feeling powerless and inadequate as adults. Many of these killers also sexually abuse their victims, but they are not motivated by feelings. Mm. To them, rape simply is another form of dominating the victim.
Yeah.
I did have a look on, because this was on a separate site, but on Wikipedia for serial killers, they have more categories for types of serial killers, but these are like your four main ones that come up quite a lot. But we managed to find a report. Ainsworth, this chap, he did like a full in-depth report about serial killers, like in different countries and different cultural backgrounds and stuff like that. So I'll explain the findings.
Cool.
So countries that produce the largest number of serial killers, can you guess what that is?
America.
Can you guess the top four? America is number one.
I feel like there's got to be a South American country in there.
Well, you're close with the South bit, but it's not American.
Oh. At South Africa?
Yeah, that's number three.
Oh, okay. Are the other two in Europe, or is one in, like, Asia?
So the second one is England, and the fourth one is Canada.
Oh, so I'm going to go live in Asia, because you're least likely to get murdered over there.
You think. These are, like, court serial killers, so...
Oh, yeah, good point.
Yeah. So United States apparently have 2,743 court serial killers. England, 145.
Hang on. America's like 21,000.
27,000.
Oh, okay. 2,700. I was like, what?
Yeah, can you imagine? Legit, like, a very large majority of the country. It's not a large majority at all. I can't do maths.
Well, neither can my brain tonight, apparently. I can't even listen to numbers. Sorry, carry on.
Bye. So England have 145, South Africa 112, and Canada 101.
America is still like way ahead of the rest of us.
Yeah.
And that's not something that they should be proud of.
No. They should be having a badge saying we caught the most serial killers.
No.
Like maybe they should be figuring out why they're having so many serial killers.
But then I suppose their country's a lot bigger than like England, isn't it?
Yeah, but for England, 145, like for such a short, like a small area of space, that's quite a lot, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how old the research is that I've written down. I mean, this could have been updated, it could have changed, but yeah, that's what it currently is. So what city has had the most serial killers, do you think? This is the American city.
Is it Los Angeles?
No, other side.
New York?
Yeah. So New York with 137 victims of serial murder.
Aww.
Surprisingly. I wasn't expecting New York to be on there for some reason. I was definitely expecting like Texas.
Oh yeah. So my next guess after New York was going to be like, I don't know, Chicago or somewhere up north. But yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting it. How many serial killers do you walk by in a lifetime?
Oh, is it actually a scary amount?
I think the answer's still quite scary, but it's not as high as you would think.
Oh, is it like 2 or 3?
No, it's definitely higher than that.
Oh, is it like higher than 10?
Yeah.
Oh, no, is it between 10 and 20? Why don't I just say a number? 14.
You're close, 16.
Oh, okay, fair.
No, that's
horrendous.
Yeah. So you think like there'll be a point in your life or there has already been a point in your life where someone's considered on murdering you? I'd be like, I'm flattered, but no.
Yeah, thanks, but not today.
So... Male serial killers are nearly 6 times as likely to kill a stranger, whereas females are almost twice as likely to kill a person they are familiar with, which makes sense, to be honest.
Yeah.
65.4% of male serial killers, to one degree or another, have stalked their victims before murdering them, compared to 3.6% of female serial killers.
That doesn't surprise me either.
I think it's just bare effort for females to have to stalk people, so.
Well, I think ladies are more scared of being got by men when they're out and about on their own, so there wouldn't be as many opportunities.
Yeah, so 42% of convicted serial killers suffered from physical abuse, and 74% suffered from psychological abuse. 35% witnessed sexual abuse, and 43% were sexually abused themselves. In the year 1900, so there was 49 killings in total for the US alone. Internationally, there was 23 killings, so a total of 72 killings just for that year. Now, you see a spike in the 1990, yeah, with 669 killings in the US alone. Internationally, it was 322. So that was a total of 991 killings.
Blimey.
And then in 2010, it goes down again. So there's 117 killings in the US. And then internationally, it was 113, which is a total of 230.
Yeah.
And that was the amount of killings they had.
Murders,
yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. It almost makes you wonder, though, like in 1900, whether they just... There could have been more, but they just couldn't trace them. And then, like, in 1990, all of a sudden, science got a little bit better, so they caught loads of people. And then by the next year that you said, I can't remember what year it was, by that point, people have learned. Yeah, so people have, like, either learned how to get around the new methods, or people have just stopped, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, could be some of the advancements in technology means it's easier to catch criminals, maybe, or to parents, so they're less likely to commit the crime.
Yeah.
Essentially. But they could just have got really smart about killing people, making it look like coronavirus.
Yeah. That's a conspiracy theory in itself now, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it actually?
What, coronavirus?
Yeah.
Yeah, people are saying that it's like the government's way of sort of keeping us distracted from what's really going on.
Well, we can talk about that in our podcast, don't we?
Yeah.
A year on after the coronavirus.
Did you hear that pop?
Yeah.
New bottle.
Okay. So based on Radford University serial killer database, so we're going back to the years that I've already spoken about, 1900, 1919, 2010. So 1900, out of all the killings, there was 45 that men were responsible for.
Yeah.
27 were women. And then we have a dramatic spike in 1990, where 922 killings were men and 69 were women.
Yeah, this was internationally as well, it's not just the US.
Yeah.
In 2010, 214 were men and then 16 were just women.
Women aren't killing as much as men at all, are they?
No. Not statistically.
And then I did write the percentages here. So in 1900, it was 62.5% for men, 37.5% for women. 1990 was 93% for men and 7.1% for women.
Blimey.
And then 2010 was still 93% for men, but 7% for women. So it gone by 0.1% for women.
Yeah. But I think it might be influenced by the fact that you've got like bias as well, naturally, within the justice system. So when you're like, women are seen as the fairer sex. Still today in the court of law, so it's more shocking when a woman does commit a murder, the less likely to be pinned for it, basically.
And like in Chicago, I feel like it was self-defense is probably more believed when it's a woman saying it rather than a man.
Yeah, because we're seen as like the less aggressive
sex.
With the fairer sex, as it were.
I mean, most of the time it is out of defense, so isn't it, unless you happen to get a kick out of it and start killing.
Yeah.
In theory.
But then you've got, like, you know, the oddballs, like, you know, Rose West, for example, who's an absolute psychopath and probably worse than some other, like, male serial killers.
Yeah.
Have you listened to the podcast about Rose West?
No.
It's horrific.
It is, actually. It was a struggle to listen to it, to be honest.
Yeah. Like, I felt so sorry for her children.
Yeah.
Oh, Christ.
Fucking bitch.
I'll add it to my list of many things to listen to and watch.
The best one, it's those conspiracy guys that does it, Fred and Rose West. They're very nonchalant about it. And then I'm just sat there going, this is horrific. Oh my God. What the fuck? And I was just like, yeah, so she just casually like started doing this shit, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no. So I wrote down the percentages out of, like, you know, the different types of serial killers that I mentioned earlier. They worked out the percentages just in the US alone. So for murders in relation to enjoyment, so that would be thrill, lust, or power, altogether it was 36.86%. In the US alone, it was 31.76%. So that was quite a large majority. And then that was the highest one that was on the little table in the report. And then the one at the very bottom of the report was for attention. So altogether, internationally, it was 0.49%. And then for the US, it was 0.50%.
Yeah.
So again, that was like a large majority of the murders that were being recorded, basically.
Basically, either mommy didn't give me any attention or give me attention or I'll go kill someone.
Can you imagine if you said that? If like,
if I'm starved for attention.
If like my kids turned around to me and said that, I'd be like, get a grip of yourself. Anyway. So I hope you learned something from that.
I did. I looked into the infamous Aileen Wuornos. Again, I've picked another person and I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce their name. I feel like this is a bit of a theme coming on in our podcast. Aileen.
Okay, Aileen. But it's American, isn't it? So it could be Arlene.
It's got an A at the beginning, though, rather than an E. Aileen Wuornos. She was born in Michigan in the USA in February 1956. Now, we've mentioned in the, like, podcast before that there's a case of, like, nature versus nurture, isn't there, where what makes a serial killer? So I did a bit of background on her as well, like her life growing up, and it's a little bit horrific. So her mum was 14 when she got married to her dad. He was 16. Aileen never met her father because he was in prison when she was born. He was schizophrenic and later convicted of sex crimes against children. Pretty good job she never met him. He hung himself in prison in 1969. Her mum abandoned her and her older brother, and her maternal grandparents adopted them both in 1960, but both her grandparents were alcoholics. When she was 11, she was engaging in sexual activities in school in exchange for cigarettes, drugs, and food. And she also supposedly was doing sexual activities with her brother. She said her granddad had beaten and sexually abused her when she was a child. So when she was 14, she got pregnant after being raped by one of her granddad's friends. She gave birth in one of those homes for unwed mothers in March 1971, and it was a little baby boy who she gave up for adoption. She dropped out of school a few months later. About this time, her grandma died of liver failure because, you know, alcoholic. So her granddad threw her out. So she was 15, living in the woods, supported herself by becoming a prostitute. Not going to lie, that's pretty horrific childhood.
Yeah, that's pretty bad right there.
Yeah.
But that's a lot. I'm not saying, you know, if that happens, the solution is to go out and murder people. But what I'm saying is it's fairly commonplace for people to be that damaged to go and do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Which I feel kind of bad for her, but then at the same time, I'm not the girl. Yeah. It's a bit like the whole bully situation, though, isn't it? Like, I suppose most people that bully people have usually been bullied themselves, either by a parent or people older than older brothers and sisters, other kids, whatever. But it's still kind of hard to feel sorry for the bully.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you'll feel sorry for her or not after the end of this.
Probably not.
So, but her criminal record started when she was 18. She got charged with a DUI, disorderly conduct. Disorderly conduct and firing a 22 caliber pistol from a moving vehicle. She was then charged with failure to appear because she didn't turn up in court. Then in 1976, when she was about 20, she hitchhiked to Florida, where she met and married a 69-year-old yacht club president. She hit him with his own cane, leading him to get a restraining order against her within weeks of the wedding. She was then in loads of bar fights and she was briefly in jail for assault. She returned to Michigan at this point, and then in July 1976, she was arrested and charged with assault and disturbing the peace for throwing a cue ball at a bartender's head. She sounds like a delightful character.
And the bar night, isn't it? Someone's always getting hit by a ball.
It's not a good night unless someone's getting glass.
Yeah, exactly. Or having a fight.
Come on, then.
So then her brother died, so she received $10,000 from his life insurance. She used this money to annul her marriage after being married for 9 weeks. She paid a fine for drunk driving, and then she used the rest of the money to, it says she spent the rest in 2 months on luxuries, including a car, which she wrecked shortly afterwards. So, 1981, she's arrested for armed robbery, armed robbery of a convenience store. She stole $35 and two packs of cigarettes. In 1984, she was arrested for attempting to pass forged checks at the bank. In 1985, she was a suspect in a theft of a revolver and some ammo. In January of 1986, she was arrested for car theft, resisting arrest, obstruction of justice. And then in June, her male companion claimed she pulled a gun on him and demanded $200. Around this time, she met a woman called Tyria Moore, who was a maid at a hotel. She met her at a lesbian bar and they moved in together, and Eileen supported them with her earnings from being a prostitute. So she married like this 69-year-old yacht dude, and now she's kind of a lesbian.
Well, I mean, otherwise she married the 69-year-old guy that owns the yacht.
Oh yeah, of course.
I wonder.
But she wasn't nice enough to him to get any money off him, because he got a restraining order against her within like a week of being married.
Exactly, like
she obviously had kids.
Yeah. If you want, right, if you're gonna have a sugar daddy, you've got to be nice enough long enough for them to put your name in the will. I'm just putting it out there.
Exactly.
You can't just start throwing shit out of their head. It doesn't work like that, because you're certainly not going to get any money.
It depends on how hot you are, really, because some men will just be like, I don't care that you're crazy, you're just hot, so it doesn't matter.
Well, I like to think that I'm like intermediate, so I'd get somewhat the earnings. I'm not saying I'm out there, I'm just saying I'm crazy enough, but I think it levels it out.
Mm.
Yeah. So in 1987, both Eileen and her girlfriend were detained by police at a bar regarding an incident where they were accused of assault and battery with a beer bottle. In 1988, she accused a bus driver of assault and claims that he pushed her off the bus following a confrontation, and her girlfriend was the only witness, of course.
Convenient.
So, in November of 1989, this is when she started killing people. So she only killed a total of 7 men, but she did it in a period of 12 months. I'm saying only 7, like it's casual that you just kill 7 men.
Yeah, but I suppose record-wise, it's relatively low, isn't it?
No, that is a casual night, though, isn't it? I mean, not 9. Not 9.
You're on a casual killing spree of 7 men on a night. Average Saturday.
I need to stop drinking, it's messing with my brain cells.
They are all middle-aged white men.
Shocker.
The first one, Richard, was 51. He was a convicted rapist, and she claimed she killed him in self-defense because he sodomized and brutally beat her after he drove her to an abandoned area for sexual requests. 2 days later, his car was found by the police. In December, his body was found several miles away in a woodland area, and he had been shot several times. The 2 bullets in his left lung were the main cause of death. In May 1990, she killed a guy called David, who was 47. Well, he went missing for ages. He was a construction worker, and then, so he went missing in May, and then in June, his naked body was found by the side of a road with 6 bullet wounds. Also in May, she killed Charles, who was 40. He was a part-time rodeo worker. I don't know why. In June, his body was found. He'd been shot 9 times. His body had been wrapped in an electric blanket and was badly decomposing. And witnesses say they saw Eileen in possession of his car, and she'd also pawned off one of his guns, which is why they could associate it to her. June that year, she killed Peter, who was 65. He was a retired merchant seaman. His car was found abandoned in July. He had been seen with her leaving the car, and her palm print was found on the door handle inside, but his body still hasn't been found. July, she killed Troy, who was 50. He was a sausage salesman.
Is that an actual job? I thought it'd just be a butcher.
I don't know.
Sausage salesman. Excuse me, sir, do you have any bacon? No, I only sell sausages.
So he was reported missing in July, and then in August, his body was found in another wooded area, and he'd been shot twice. September, she kills Charles, also known as Dick. He was 56 and a retired US Air Force major. He was a former child abuse investigator and former chief of police. His body was found fully clothed. He'd been shot 6 times in the head and torso, and his car was found an hour and a half drive away. And then the last one in November 1990 was Walter. He was 62. He was a trucker and a security guard, and I think he was in the police reserves. His nearly naked body was found near a remote logging road. He'd been shot 4 times, and his car was later found 3.5 hours drive away. So the first guy she killed was like a convicted rapist, and then like the last couple of guys she killed are like former child abuse investigator, chief of police, police reservist. So the kind of pattern kind of changes slightly towards the end. So, no, in July 1990, so this is in the middle of her killing spree, there was a media campaign to locate her and her girlfriend, because people had found the victim's belongings in pawn shops and they got fingerprints matching hers from not only the cars, but from these pawned items. And obviously they had her prints already because she's got a huge criminal record.
Yeah.
So in January 1991, she was arrested at the Last Resort, which is a biker bar in Florida. A few days later, they found her girlfriend in Scranton, Pennsylvania, which made me laugh because that's where the office is based.
Right.
Eileen's girlfriend agreed to help to get a confession out of her in return for immunity from prosecution.
Little snake.
Yeah, little snake. In January 1991, Eileen confessed to the murders, but she claimed they tried to rape her and it was self-defense. Psychiatrists for the defense testified that she was mentally unstable. She had borderline personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder. So they did, there's like a psychopathy test. She scored 32 out of 40 on this test. And anything over 25, you considered a psychopath. So she was well and truly a psychopath.
What's that noise?
I feel like it's us echoing.
Are we echoing on your end? Sorry.
Not really. Is it my papers?
I just hear like a what?
I don't know. It could be my chair.
No.
Anyway, sorry.
So she's got anything over 25.
Yeah. So she's a complete psychopath. She talked about being taken away to meet God and Jesus and the angels and whatever is beyond the beyond. In the end, she pleaded no contest to the murders of three of them, saying she wanted to get right with God. And then she said, I wanted to confess to you that Richard Mallory did violently rape me, as I've told you, but these others did not. They only began to start to. So like the first dude actually raped her and then the rest didn't. She just kind of made it up.
Did she say they started to?
Yeah.
Why is she almost getting raped by all of these men? Like, I'm not about this whole big victim blaming culture, but what I'm saying is it's a little bit suspicious that all of these men are dead and her excuse was they all tried to rape me.
Yeah.
Well, one did and all the rest tried.
She's still she's a sex worker, and I know sex workers can still be raped. Absolutely. Yeah. That's a whole issue in itself. However, she was with these men alone in their cars a lot of the time, supposedly to do working. So I'm not saying that they didn't start to rape her. I'm just saying, I don't know, it's just a bit,
it kind of comes like, this is going to sound really bad, but it kind of comes with the territory. I mean,
yeah, I suppose that's why you have pimps really, don't you, because you've got people that will try and take advantage, like they will try and take sex without payment
and brothels and stuff like that.
But
I don't believe that every single person that she's come into contact with has tried to rape her.
I feel like more so it's something to do with money. Like either they've tried to have their way and not pay.
Yeah.
Or maybe she was robbing them.
Yeah.
I think she was probably robbing them.
No, she was because she was pawning them.
Yeah, she was pawning stuff.
Yeah.
So that's probably it could have been an excuse as well.
Probably.
So obviously if she was working as a sex worker, she would have been probably on her ass money wise.
But then it would have been actually scientifically proven by tests and stuff if she would have been raped that often. They would have been, surely they've been able to test.
They attempted the rest of them, didn't they? There was only one of them that actually did. So, and that will only stay, like the DNA will only stay for a certain amount of time. And obviously if she's gone and being a sex worker, she's not likely to report something like that anyway.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
How often
of sex workers over there do that?
Yeah, like it's really hard to get a conviction in a rape case anyway, let alone if you're a sex worker, because straight away they've got that's your job, innit?
Which is horrific.
Exactly the justice system.
But in the end, she received 6 death sentences because they never found the seventh guy's body. So they couldn't prove that she actually killed him. So she was on death row for 10 years, which I think is just cruel. She was executed in October 2002 by lethal injection, and her last meal was just a cup of coffee. But before they actually finally executed her, she said that prison staff were trying to get her to kill herself. They were poisoning her food, plenty of strip searches, tight cuffing, door kicking, frequent room searches, low water pressure, catcalling, and there was mildew on her mattress. She just said she was completely treated unfairly whilst waiting to be killed.
Yeah.
Pretty sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
especially with what the type of person she is, again, like, she will be judged by people in the justice system. So yeah. They probably just didn't see her as a human being.
No.
Which is so wrong. But I mean, even though she's a murderer, but it's not the point, is it?
No.
Like you almost help to create these kind of people by doing those sort of things to people.
Oh yeah, exactly.
The whole point of the justice system though is obviously it's like you treat them fairly because they're still human at the end of the day and they've still got human rights. So you shouldn't be treating them like yeah. that, especially if they're already waiting to get killed by yeah. whatever means necessary.
Well, originally the purpose of creating prisons and things like that was to actually not punish people, because it's not meant to punish people, it's meant to rehabilitate people.
Yeah.
But obviously there's a grey area when it comes to the death penalty, because, you know, where do you draw the line?
Yeah.
No better than the killers.
Yeah.
They're no better than the killers and the rapists and the paedophiles that they keep in there if they're just going to abuse them, because they're just going to encourage them.
Yeah, definitely.
By any means that they managed to get let out to continue what they were already doing before they got caught.
Yeah. And you've just got that vicious cycle of people going back into prison because it's easier, because once you've been hard with something, it's difficult to shake that, and you're not going to get a decent job, or, you know, you're going to get looked at in the wrong way your whole yeah. life just because of potentially a mistake you made. I don't think in this case it's a mistake.
The quote I'm yeah. about to say, like, it was obviously the right decision to kill her, and she believed that too, because she said, "I killed those men, robbed them cold as ice, and I'd do it again too. There's no chance in keeping me alive or anything, because I'd kill again. I have hate crawling through my system. I'm so sick of hearing this 'she's crazy' stuff. I've been evaluated so many times. I'm competent, sane, and I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm one who seriously hates human life and would kill again." So
yeah, that's probably the psychopathy talking as well.
Yeah,
because, you know, she's unable to connect with other people. That's yeah. part of being a psychopath.
I think with the childhood that she's had.
Yeah, yeah, exactly what I was about to say. I think part of that does stem from people treating her horrendously her entire life. She doesn't know how to be treated well, does she?
Yeah.
Yeah. Age circles back around to nature versus nurture, isn't it? Like, she obviously had a shitty life, but also with her being quite high on the psychopathic scale, she's, I mean, technically being a psychopath is having a mental health disorder.
Yeah.
So again, you've got like grade blur lines there as well, because yes, she was brought up in a horrendous way and probably would have still killed anyway.
Yeah.
Because of her circumstances, but her having that psychopathic behaviour is like added fuel to the fire.
But I think I would have said the same as well. But maybe if she released me, I'm going to kill again, because
yeah.
Yeah.
But maybe she would have still killed even if she didn't have that horrible life as well.
Like, yeah, there's no way of knowing, is there?
Yeah. I mean, not everybody that is a psychopath ends up murdering, because it's only like 1% of yeah. psychopaths actually are murderers.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Or less than 1%, should I say.
I think it depends how far you push people, though, because I think, like, we always talk about how everybody's capable of killing. It just depends how far you push them to yeah. obviously make them kill.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, so I don't feel sorry for her. I just think there's so many things that, like, there's so many similarities in all these cases, and it's just like, it feels not like it's correlation, it feels like it's causation. Like, yeah. these people having children that are not equipped to have children are contributing to the problem. The justice system is contributing to the problem. There's like so many things contributing to the problem.
There's like aspects that are like contributing to that problem, make too much money. So yeah. they're never going to stop that from happening. Never going to stop people from having, like, underage pregnancies and stuff, or the justice system being absolutely shocking.
Yeah, and then some people can't get abortions safely, can they, either? And people are voting against that, yeah. which is another part of the problem.
Well, did you, speaking of that, did you see the, what are they called now? Oh, my God, like, it's not parade.
Protesters.
Protests.
Oh, protests.
Protests.
Jesus. In Poland.
Yeah, the Warsaw, for the abortion yeah. one, loads of fucking women were there.
Yeah,
good. Well, finally done, because it is a very Catholic country.
Yeah.
Very, very set against abortion, and Jesus.
Well, I'm sorry, it's nobody's choice except the woman who's carrying the child. Yes, the father that helped create that child should have an input because it's, you know, part of him as well. But at the end of the day, it's, you're in charge of your own body, and yeah, nobody has the right to tell you that you can't do something. Like, no. I personally, like, abortion isn't for me personally, but if I was in a shitty situation where I knew I couldn't look after that child, why bring a child into the world
that's
going to suffer when, you know, mistakes happen? And it's not even just mistakes sometimes. Like, it, you know, you can be genuinely careful and things can fail.
Yeah, or right.
You shouldn't then punish that child for the rest of their life because of that.
Yeah.
It's them that ultimately loses out. Like, all these pro-lifers are not pro-life at all. They're pro-pregnancy, because as soon as that child comes into the world, these are the same people that turn around and say, well, you had the child, I am paying my taxes for your kid.
Exactly.
You force that woman to have that child.
But do you know how ridiculous it is, though, that a fetus has more human rights than a woman does?
Yeah.
And it's not even born yet. It's, like, technically in limbo.
Yeah.
I mean, it's called amniotic fluid, but, yeah, we can call it limbo.
A fancy word, it's not really fancy at all, it's just
that's what limbo is, and be able to
heard it on here.
Checkable fact. Okay, it's me now, isn't it?
It is.
So I can say a name, I think. I'm just going to put that disclaimer in there. I do apologise if I offend any Japanese people with my pronunciation of these names. I understand the problem being called Morgina. You know, I get that a lot myself. But, yeah, I do apologise if I offend anybody. So the person that I looked up is obviously from Japan. Was active from 1944 to 1948. And she is considered the world's worst female serial killer, because she has the highest death toll. So she was also known as Oni Samba, which translates to demon midwife. So her name is Miyuki Ishikawa, and she had 85 confirmed victims, or they reckon that there is 169 possible victims in total.
Oh my gosh, that's loads.
She was busy.
Yeah. So she was a hospital director and an experienced midwife at the Kotobuki Maternity Hospital. And then when the police started investigating, they initially found 5 dead bodies, but then later found over 40 in a house of mortician. And then an additional 30 bodies were later discovered in a temple.
Oh my God, in a temple?
Yeah.
Ooh.
So Miyuki, she had a husband, Takeshi Ishikawa.
Takeshi?
Takeshi, yeah.
Like Ishikawa. Takeshi's castle?
Yep.
I don't think they're similar in the slightest.
Are they related?
So he was in on it, and he was helping her. And they were actually arrested in 1948. So
that's a lot of... Did you say she was active over 4 years?
4 years, yeah.
That's a lot of people to kill.
How many confirmed? 85?
85 in 4 years. Like,
very, very busy.
That's record shit, that is.
Well, that would be like... For 4 years, that would be like 20... summit deaths per year.
Yeah, but when I describe it a bit more, you see why she was able to get away with that.
Okay.
So yeah, they were arrested on the 15th of January 1948, and they were sent she was sentenced to 8 years, which was later reduced. Yeah, 8 years, which was later reduced to 4.
What?
In Tokyo.
What the fuck?
Yeah, and he got 2 years.
Oh
yeah.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
So originally it was an 8-year sentence. They appealed in 1952 to the Tokyo High Court, and that's when it was reduced to 4 years. And the reason is because of the way Japan was set up at that time. So I'll talk a bit more about it in a sec. Essentially, so there's not much about her in terms of background, but we do know that she had a college degree. She had part of her education by attending the University of Tokyo. She had no children of herself, and her crime of choice was actually infanticide.
Oh, which when you're a midwife, that's pretty easy to do.
Yeah. So that's how she managed to get away with all of this. So she had. So essentially, she had many parents at the ward who had infants who were too poor to raise the children without some sort of financial struggle.
Yeah.
And she herself said that she couldn't help because of a lack of social and charitable services. So her solution was to neglect the infants and many died as a direct result from that.
Oh, that's so really sad.
Literally not taking care of them, not feeding them, not
that would break my heart.
Them.
That would actually break my heart.
Yeah, they passed away as a direct result. So it's pretty sad, really. And then apparently the other midwives actually knew about it and but were said to be disgusted by the practice, so actually resigned, but didn't do anything about it. They just resigned.
That's awful.
Yeah. And she then, with help from her husband, tried to get money from the parents of these children by saying that it was less expensive to pay her than it would be to raise a child who was unwanted anyway.
Yeah.
So that was her sort of reasoning.
Absolute scammer.
Yeah. And there was also another doctor called Shiro Nakayama, I hope I'm saying that wrong, who was also found to be complicit in this scheme because she was falsifying death certificates. So she ended up getting 4 years as well. A lot of people knew about this because obviously there was a doctor that was helping her, there was the parents of the children, and then there was the other midwives, and also the Shinjuku ward office knew what was going on but ignored it.
Oh my God, that's so many horrendous people there.
I know.
But it just goes to show that maybe it was an actual real problem there, that these parents that couldn't afford kids, there was no real support system for them or the children.
Yeah, like when I read a little bit further down, you'll start to understand a little bit more as well.
Yeah.
So basically alongside this, similar cases have actually occurred in Japan before. So the people of Habashi were accused in 1930 of murdering 41 foster children.
Fucking hell.
A person called Hatsutaro Kawamata. I'll put all of these on the Instagrams just in case. was arrested in 1933 for murdering at least 25 foster children.
Blimey.
And the Japanese government were also aware of this happening but did nothing.
This is so sad.
Yeah, and apparently a lot of the reason for all of this is because basically Japanese tradition disputed the rights of infants. So,
wait, disputed the rights that infants had to even be alive?
Yeah, so essentially, you've got your essential human rights and then you've got animal rights, but you haven't got any specific rights for children. Yeah. And I think even at this time in Japan, they didn't even have animal rights at that point anyway. So
if you weren't a fully fledged like adult,
yeah,
you didn't have like the basic human rights that everyone in England is entitled to.
Yeah,
that's awful.
You're essentially your parents' property, aren't you?
Yeah. And if the parents decide to sell you to someone who's going to kill you, then loophole.
Why not? Yeah. So the defense that she actually used were that the children were deserted by their parents. So she insisted that the parents were responsible for the deaths, not her, especially because obviously they knew about it. And they were responsible for the child because it's their child.
Yeah.
So she claimed that basically it had nothing to do with her. And because of the length of time that all of these crimes happened over, it was difficult to determine the exact number of victims. And then when it was going through the courts, the authorities viewed her crimes as a crime of omission.
Mm.
Which is basically failure to act, which generally attracts different consequences from positive conduct.
Yeah,
she didn't do an
alien and shot people. She just kind of neglected them, ignored
them to pass away by not giving them what they needed. Yeah, the positive part that came out of this, I suppose, is that this case has actually set a precedent. So it's the principal reason that the Japanese government began to consider the legalisation of abortion in Japan, when abortion was illegal.
Yeah.
That obviously contributed. And people believe one of the contributing factors to the case was the fact that there's an increase in the number of unwanted infants born in Japan.
Yeah.
Obviously with the lack of social support and not being able to have an abortion, you kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Because
you have the child, you're not going to be able to look after them.
Yeah.
And potentially they could, you know, die due to malnutrition and things like that anyway.
Yeah.
Or you're also not allowed to have an abortion. So either way, if you get pregnant, that just is what it is. It's unfortunate. So in June 24th of June 1949, abortions for economic reasons were legalised.
Cool.
Because on the 13th of July 1948, so the previous year, there was a law passed which was known as the Mother's Body Protection Law, and a national examination system for midwives was established. So it all had sort of this knock-on effect because of the precedent that it set.
Yeah,
so,
which is a good thing.
Yeah, so I mean, as horrific as the case is, and you know, horrible as it is to think about how many infants you actually murdered, at least some good came out of it for the Japanese people in terms of abortion being legalized and things.
Yeah,
I mean, it doesn't make it right.
No, not at all. But
it's nice that it wasn't just ignored by all of these people and then just dropped.
Yeah. I thought, like, I was researching for Myra Hindley, and I thought, oh no, I can't say half of this stuff because it's about like really young kids, because all their victims are kids. And then I was like, oh okay, never mind.
So much worse when it's kids.
Yeah, I actually really struggled to like write the stuff down because it went into very graphic detail about how like the kid got killed.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, not nice when kids are bored. When it's like adults, I'm not really as sensitive to the information.
Yeah.
Kids is just more horrific because they're so vulnerable and gullible.
They can't really defend themselves, can they?
No, so, exactly.
And it's not necessarily their fault. Like, they're just innocent bystanders that just happen to get targeted by adults.
Yeah. I'm just kind of glad, to be honest, that when I was researching this Miyuki Ishikawa, that there isn't a lot of detail. There's not a lot that goes into the depth of, you know, how she killed the children or anything like that. I don't think it would be too horrific anyway because of the fact that it was pretty much due to neglect, but still, it's sometimes a blessing when you look into these things and they don't tell you how, you know, all the nitty gritty details about how people died.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a harrowing episode, hasn't it?
I know. So my female serial killer is Myra Hindley, and she's a piece of shit. You can cut that out. I don't mind. I feel like I'm going to get hate at some point when we do this podcast because I'm going to say something and you're going to be like, no, it's fine, we'll just keep it in. And then they're like, I can't believe you just said that.
At some point, we're both guaranteed to get some sort of hate just because people interpret things you say differently and wrong, don't they? So we'll see.
Okay.
Fun fact, did you know that Rose West and Myra Hindley were in the same prison together and were best buds for a short amount of time until Rose had butted Myra in the face and they were lesbian lovers?
Okay, so Myra Hindley, she is characterised as the most evil woman in Britain. She made several appeals against her life sentence but was rejected. She was claiming she was a reformed woman and no longer a danger to society. I call bullshit.
Oh, smell the bullshit.
Yup. She was involved in the Moors murders, which was carried out by Myra and Ian Brady between July 1963 and October 1965 in and around Manchester. There were five victims altogether. At least four of these victims were sexually assaulted. Two of the victims were discovered in graves dug in Saddleworth Moor. A third grave wasn't discovered there until 20 years later. After Brady and Hindley's trial, I go into a little bit of a background about Myra. So she was born on 23rd of July 1942, and she died 15th of November 2002, aged 60, from pneumonia.
Was she still in prison at that point?
Yes.
Good.
She was never allowed out of prison, even though, as I said earlier, she tried to make several appeals against her life sentence, but they were like, nah, not letting you out.
Good.
So a little bit about her background. She was born and raised in a working class area of Manchester to parents Nellie and Bob Hindley. Her father was an alcoholic. Both parents beat her regularly when she was a young child.
Aww.
The house was in poor condition and Myra was forced to sleep in a single bed next to her parents' double. Myra had a younger sister born August 1946, and about a year later she was sent to live with her grandmother.
So kind of rough childhood.
Yeah, I mean, not as bad as obviously like Aileen. I was gonna say Aileen. I don't know anymore. And obviously Morgina's serial killer, but you know, obviously still getting beaten up by your parents isn't the one. So Hindley's father had served with the parachute regiment and had been stationed in North Africa, Cyprus and Italy during the Second World War. He had been known as a hard man and he expected his daughter to be equally as tough. So I think it goes into some sort of detail about how she had an altercation with another kid at school. And obviously this kid pushed her over and she ran over to her dad and the dad was like, we're not leaving until you punch him back.
Yeah, interesting lessons to teach your kids.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I understand, like, teaching your kids to stand up for themselves, you know, it's great for, you know, not allowing people to walk over you and stuff, but he was quite forceful in that way.
Yeah.
So in January 1961, the 18-year-old Hindley joined Millwards as a typist. She soon became infatuated with Brady, despite learning he had a criminal record. She had begun a diary, and although had other dates with other men, some of the entries detail her fascination with Brady, to whom she eventually spoke for the first time on the 27th of July. Over the next few months, she became quite disillusioned with him, until eventually he asked her on a date. The dates followed a regular pattern: a trip to the cinema, usually to watch an X-rated film, then back to Hindley's house to drink German wine. Brady then gave her a reading material, and the pair spent lunch breaks reading aloud to one another from accounts of Nazi atrocities.
That sounded really cute up until you said accounts of Nazi and atrocities. It's like, oh, they go watch films together and read to each other. Oh, no, wait.
There's always a downside to it.
Yeah.
Because obviously you have to think as well, 1942, it wasn't that long after the war. So obviously the economy was still trying to, like, rebuild itself back up.
I think 1942, we were still in World War II.
Possibly.
Yeah, it ended in 1945.
So obviously the war's still going on at that point then. I don't know why they're reading out Nazi atrocities, but, you know.
Because they're sick fucks.
Simply put. Hindley began to emulate an ideal of the Aryan perfection. She started bleaching her hair blonde and applying thick crimson lipstick. She expressed concern at some of the aspects of Brady's character. In a letter to a friend, she mentioned an incident where she'd been drugged by Brady, but also wrote of her obsession with him. A few months later, she asked a friend to destroy the letter.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, she was already aware that he had a criminal background. He was already a bit of a dodgy character, but for some reason, in her mind, it would have been like love at first sight kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then he even tried to drug her. So I don't know what happened when he drugged her.
No.
Obviously, she asked.
She probably doesn't know either, if she was drugged and unconscious.
True. And then obviously, even like if you found out that you were getting drugged by someone you were dating.
Nope the fuck out of there.
Yeah. Yeet. Bye. So Hindley claimed that Brady began to talk about committing the perfect murder in July 1963. By June 1963, so we're going back a month, Brady had moved into Hindley's grandmother's house. And on July 12th, 1963, the two murdered their first victim, Reed, who had attended school with Hindley's younger sister. Police found no one who had seen Reed before her disappearance, and no one was convicted at the time. Their next victim was Kilbride, who they killed on 23rd of November 1963. So Hindley hired a vehicle a week after Kilbride went missing, and again on the 21st of December to make sure the burial sites had not been disturbed. In 1964, Hindley and Brady and her grandmother were rehoused as part of the post-war slum clearances in Manchester. They became friendly with an 11-year-old girl who lived on the street.
The
girl joined Brady. I was like really struggling like to read it and then have to write it. I was like, how can I make this listener friendly? You can't. That's what.
Don't worry, I'll put a disclaimer.
Yeah. The girl joined Brady and Hindley on their trips to Saddleworth Moor to collect peat, something that many householders did to improve the soils in their gardens. She remained unharmed due to living so close to the duo. Her disappearance would be easily solved.
Yeah.
So she technically had a lucky escape, but obviously the other victims did not. So Pauline Reed, she was 16 years old. Duo felt that a teenager going missing will receive less attention than an 8-year-old. Once she was in the van, Hindley asked her help in searching Saddleworth Moor for an expensive lost glove. Reed agreed and they drove there. Brady arrived later on his motorcycle. Hindley told Reed that he was helping in the search. Hindley claimed she waited in the van whilst the other two went onto the moor. Brady returned alone after about 30 minutes and took Hindley to where Reed lay dying. Her clothes were in disarray and she had been nearly decapitated by two cuts to the throat.
Oh my God.
Including a 4-inch incision across her voice box, inflicted with considerable force. When Hindley asked Brady whether he had raped her, she replied, "Of course I did." Brady stated in his account, Hindley was not only present for the attack, but participated in the sexual assault.
Oh, that's so horrific.
Yeah, so obviously there's two like perspectives here. So Grady's turning around and saying that Hindley was involved in all of it, and Hindley's saying, no, I just waited in the van. You never actually find out the actual truth, because obviously she's died. I'm pretty sure he's dead.
Yeah.
As well. So they never really admit to the full truth.
You never find out, because obviously you can't know every single detail from back then.
And she was obviously trying to appeal to get back out and say she wasn't a danger to anyone. But obviously in this case, if they were to believe what Brady was saying, she was like,
I was watching a documentary where I found that fact about how her and Rose were in the same prison.
Yeah.
And it was people from the prison talking about Moira, like other inmates and stuff that had like been in the prison, people that had done analysis on her and stuff like that. They all sort of agreed that she was a very manipulative person anyway. Like she was constantly trying to manipulate people in the prison. And she actually had an affair with one of the female prison guards who actually plotted to get her out.
Yeah.
So it's very clear that all of that part about her talking about being, you know, rehabilitated and not being a danger is complete nuts crap.
Yeah.
And all of them said that as well. They were like, no, we don't believe what she's got to say because of the way she's been interacting with people that she's been interviewed by and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think from the sounds of it, she's quite an intelligent woman. So especially if she's very manipulative.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that like every person that's intelligent can be that manipulative, but obviously she's had experience in doing that, especially because she's been like manipulating kids into like helping her find a lost glove.
That was part of the reason why her and Rose fell out in the first place, because obviously Rose is quite a strong character herself and she didn't appreciate Moira trying to manipulate her.
That's what
caused the blow up between them.
Anyway, the second victim was 12 years old. He got strangled with a shoelace or string. It was never determined. It was something of the variety. He was also sexually assaulted. Another victim, so this is victim three, was 12 years old again. And he died the same way as victim two. So they started developing a pattern at this point. Obviously, the first victim that they actually killed, it was a little bit messy, but luckily they were out in the moor, so they would have been able to get rid of like the evidence. They started developing like some sort of MO. So victim four was 10 years old. They actually took her back to their home. So what they had done was, I think Hindley had convinced her grandmother to stay over at some friend's house for the night or something. So obviously she wasn't there to witness any of it. They had the house for themselves and they managed to convince the 10-year-old to come back to their house. And they convinced her to get undressed and then they gagged and forced her to pose in pornographic positions for photographs. Before killing her. And then they buried her in the moors in a very shallow grave. And then the last victim that they killed, this is the reason why they got caught. So he was 17 years old and they brought him back to their house again, probably to do what they had done to the previous victim. And then at the same time, Brady and Hindley were quite close to Hindley's younger sister and her husband, David Smith. And then what Brady wanted to do was invite David Smith around because he needed help because the killer was going wrong, essentially. So Hindley went round to go get Smith and then told him to wait outside. And then he said he heard like a blood-curdling scream, like it was like someone was getting hacked, basically.
Yeah.
So he kind of shit himself. Then you hear Hindley say, oh, you need to come in, you need to help him. So he walks in and he sees the following scene of the 17-year-old half on the sofa, half on the floor. He was hit on the side of his head with a hatchet, and then later on Brady was throttling him with an electrical cord because he hadn't killed him, he hadn't hit him hard enough to actually kill him, so he was still alive at this point.
That's absolutely horrific.
So basically what happened after that was David helped him carry the body into the van that they had hired. And then he went back home, had told Hindley's younger sister, Maureen, everything that happened. They took a kitchen knife with them and then went to a telephone box, called the police and stayed there until the police turned up.
Yeah.
And that's how they got caught.
Good on him for like ratting him out though.
Yeah. That's my little bit. I'm really sorry for that's been down the mood.
That's absolutely horrifying.
there was one of the victims that never found, they never found the body. So there was only three graves that they actually dug in the moors. I'm pretty sure there was a fourth one and they never found him. Heath Bennett, yeah.
That's sad.
But yeah, she died in 2002. Unfortunately, it was not from like capital punishment, because we abolished that ages ago, didn't we?
She just missed out on the capital punishment.
Did she?
Yeah, she just missed out. When they got caught, the capital punishments have only been abolished 3 weeks when they got caught.
Yeah.
Because then they get caught in 1916.
I did write it down. Let me go
1965 back. Or something like that.
1965, yeah, so they were active for 2 years.
Yeah, capital punishment got abolished in 1965, but 3 weeks prior to them getting caught and sentenced. Otherwise, they would have got sentenced to death.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Lucky bastards.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, she was a bitch. She was actually just a bit
completely nuts.
Yeah, like she didn't have as bad of a childhood as most people do and then end up killing.
Yeah.
Especially children as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely horrible. It's pathetic, really.
Yeah. But she was like, when she was appealing and stuff, she was always saying that she was basically under the influence of Brady because of how obsessed she was and stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure that's bollocks.
She had her own motives for whatever reason.
Leads back to, you can see how manipulative she is, by the way. She interacted with the guard and got the guard fired and everything else. She was helping her. So, you know, you could quite easily imagine that she could have been the driving force behind that and manipulated Brady.
Yeah, she could.
You don't know, do you know what I mean? Just because she's female doesn't mean that she's not as sick as he is.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I completely agree with that. Some women are capable of doing that. They are capable of, like, you know, emasculating men to the point where they will start doing anything for them.
Yeah.
Lesson today, strange danger, and also, don't trust a small psychopathic blonde. I don't count. I'm quite tall.
But... No, I was about to say, it's a good job we're both quite tall.
And I'm not blonde, so...
There we go. You can trust us, guys. Thank you for listening to Gin and Spooks. Please head over to our Instagram, which is at Gin and Spooks, for the photo dump for today's episode. We also have a blog, which is ginandspooks.wordpress.com.
And if you have any ghost stories or drink suggestions of your own, please email them to us at ginandspooks@gmail.com.
Bye!
Thanks, guys. Bye.